Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today's show, November 20th, what we're going to do is continue our chapter-by-chapter assessment of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade TPP agreement that we started last week. If you didn't tune in last week, go to the archives, and I spent most of the time last week talking about the history and evolution of free trade, particularly with regard to the U.S. here since the 1980s. Take a listen to that if you are interested in that background, that context, because free trade, as I argued last week, is really about neoliberalism. It is really the foreign international program element of neoliberalism. And key to understanding that is to understand what I talked about last week when I discussed the twin deficits. In other words, with the advent of the Reagan administration, there was a big shift in U.S. policy, and that was not to continue to ensure the U.S. maintained an export surplus over imports, which was the case from 1944 through the 1960s until the crisis of the 70s and the end of the U.S. Pegging the dollar to gold in the Smithsonian agreements, which ended that pegging and pretty much led in the 70s to an open global economy. Well, the twin deficits were really about no longer trying to maximize exports over imports, but to let imports exceed exports. In other words, to allow U.S. dollars to flow out of the country into these other economies elsewhere in the world, and just about everywhere in the world, dollars flowed out to Japan and Europe and emerging markets, China, the petro-economies. And the U.S. ran a negative trade deficit from the 1980s on. And that trade deficit allowed the U.S. to run a budget deficit, a domestic budget deficit. So we see with the rise of Reagan, this combination, the twin deficits, this combination of chronic rising domestic budget deficits and trade deficits. The trade deficit enabled the U.S. to run these growing budget deficits. How did that happen? Well, the money that was flowing out because of the trade deficit came back, investing in U.S. treasuries and other sources back to the U.S. and enabled the U.S. To run a deficit, pay for the deficit by this flowing back of all these dollars. And, of course, that allowed the U.S. To chronically run deficits, and those deficits were created primarily by tax cuts for corporations and investors on the one hand, and by increased defense spending and war spending on the other hand. That was key to understanding the origins of free trade in this country, because it was in the wake of that that the first free trade agreement with Canada was negotiated in 1988-89 at the end of the Reagan period. And, of course, it immediately resulted in the expansion of free trade under Clinton, the North American Free Trade Agreement in the 1990s, and then the World Trade Organization agreeing to that, and then following that, opening up China and quasi-free trade under preferred nation trading rights with China. Under George W. Bush, we got CAFTA, Central American Free Trade Agreement, and the beginning of bilateral free trade agreements everywhere, and an attempt to establish a North and South America Free Trade Agreement, but that was headed off by South American countries forming their own Mercosur, as it's called. And then, of course, we're in the 21st century here, and we have an expansion of free trade in various bilateral and multilateral forms everywhere, of which the TPP is the latest and the biggest expression of which. That does not mean that bilateral free trade agreements are negated or no longer pursued. They are. At the same time, the U.S. is pursuing a TPP-like agreement with Europe and the TTIP and the TISA. And as most people don't know, the U.S. is pursuing the same with 50 different countries looking towards a regional free trade agreements in Africa and elsewhere. Okay, so that's the evolution. And it's important to understand the evolution of free trade and the TPP because then the specific details of TPP become more important and more recognizable. These free trade agreements are not simply about exchanging goods and even services. They are about money flows, big-time money flows, because the U.S., now dominated by financial institutions to some degree, is far more interested in not just dealing with goods and services, but relocating American businesses abroad, foreign direct investment it's called, and that requires money to flow offshore in order to finance that. And, you know, the banks, shadow banks, provide a lot of that and make a lot of money from that offshore FDI. So FDI out, as they say, from the U.S. is just as important, maybe even more so now, than goods and services flows back and forth. Of course, companies like auto companies and so forth are interested in the goods flows, and the TPP nicely accommodates the auto companies, as we'll see. So it's not just goods and services, it's also big time money flows to facilitate the goods and services and continuing U.S. Corporate multinational corporations buying up the world, which has been doing since 1945. But now it's given even more emphasis. So no controls on global money flows are a big part of this. Of course, that started during Reagan in the 1980s, and it's continued ever since, but it's part of what's required for the financialization of the global economy. Okay, so we're going to pick up from there, and we're going to look deeply in the respective chapters of the FTT, or TPP, excuse me, that I was talking about last week. But before we do that, undertake that, I want to talk about some announcements here about the show itself. Going forward, we're going to change the format of the show a little bit here. Typically, I've either had guests on that I've interviewed starting from the beginning of the show to the end, or I've talked about a topic of interest from the beginning of the show to the end. But starting next week, well, actually even this week, what we're going to do is for the first 15 minutes of the show, we're going to do what's called a roundup of key economic developments, both in the U.S. And globally. And today's roundup, I'm going to talk about some global issues and some U.S. issues as well. And then starting, today again, we're going to have a second 15-minute part of the show, which is going to be reviewing the U.S. presidential candidates' positions on various economic issues, proposals, programs, etc. So first 15 minutes, a roundup of the U.S. and global economy. Second 15 minutes, we're going to talk about one or more of the candidates and a position on one or more economic issues as we go forward here during the election year. And then in the second half of the show, the last half hour, we're going to return to our typical format of either myself talking at length about a particular issue or feature, and or having a guest come on and join me in talking about a featured issue. Okay? So that's where we're going henceforth and starting even today. Okay. So what can we say about Roundup, the economic Roundup? What's been important here in the preceding week in terms of U.S. and global economic developments? Well, globally, we've had announcement here that I've been predicting for some time that Japan enters its fifth recession since 2008. Five times Japan has slipped into recession. Well, is this a harbinger of what's happening or will happen elsewhere? Or is Japan really succumbing to the slowing global economy itself? And what does this mean for the policies Japan has been pursuing? In other words, this massive quantitative easing program, given the size of its economy, about the equivalent to the U.S., trillions of dollars. QE, of course, is where the banks, central bank actually buys up assets, bonds, not only its own government bonds, but other private bonds can buy any kind of financial asset, stocks and so forth. And Japan has been most aggressive in terms of not only the volume of its QE, but also the type and content of assets that it's buying. And, of course, what this means is that buying up assets, financial assets, gives a boon to financial asset markets. You know, that's the primary function of QE, pump up the stock and bond markets and have, you know, the quasi-government agency, the central bank, which is very influenced by the private banks, to print money electronically or whatever, and to buy these assets. Well, that increases significant demand for stocks and bonds. And that demand, of course, we know you raise demand, you're going to, all things equal, raise price of stocks and bonds. And if all the other professional investors out there know that this is happening, they anticipate price increases will occur for equities, stocks, and bonds, and so they jump in and they buy more, and that drives the price up even more. So nice capital gains here for the very wealthy 1%. You know, almost all the stocks are owned by the top 5% of households, wealthy investors, what I call in my new forthcoming book, the new finance capital elite of, you know, a couple hundred thousand of these super, super wealthy, mega wealthy professional investors out there who prefer to put their money into financial asset markets because the returns are far greater and quicker than investing in companies that produce things, and certainly not investing in small, medium companies, which are far riskier than investing in financial asset markets, that they're highly liquid, they can jump in and out any time. There's about 200,000 of these folks globally, mostly in the U.S., second largest U.K., but then Asia coming on very quickly as well. Europe, of course, in there, right up there as well. And the rest of the world, very minimal in terms of the finance capital elite. And, you know, their average liquid income creation every year is about $27 million. That's the average, $27 million. So these are folks with big money. And I'm not talking about assets here. I'm talking about flows of income generated from assets and investments. This is a group that's having extremely significant impact on the global economy now, and not all good. I do talk about that. I have a chapter on that in my forthcoming book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, which, by the way, comes out later this week. And it's not an easy read. It's about 500 pages, but it is a thorough look, if I may digress here, at the slowing global economy, both in real terms and in terms of growing financial instability, both of which are occurring simultaneously and feeding off of each other. The book first of all, takes on these forecasts, official forecasts by IMF, World Bank, and central banks and others, who continually lag behind the curve. They have been lowering their forecasts of the growth of the global economy, but well behind what's actually happening. So I discuss that, and then I look at China, Japan, emerging markets, Europe, and U.S., the current conditions in terms of instability. Then at nine key variables that I believe are behind the slowing global economy and rising financial instability. And then the last part of the book is a theoretical critique of both mainstream economics and some of the other progressive views, Marxist economics and Minskin economics and so forth, in which I finish up the book with my own theory stated here. So it's part theory, it's part material, it's part narrative empirical. You can take a look at this, if you wish, by going to my website, Kyklos Productions, kyklosproductions.com. Click on the books tab and you can get some free chapters there and look at the table of contents and the introduction and index and so forth. Okay. It's also available from the publisher Clarity Press and will be out on Amazon December 1st. You'll also be able to order from my website and from my blog, jackrasmus.com. Okay, enough of that. It's related to what we're talking about, of course. So we're talking about Japan Roundup. It's an important development going on in Japan. Fifth recession. QE does not work. Trillions and trillions of dollars of liquidity money injection into the economy boosts financial asset markets, particularly stock markets. Stock market has risen 60-70% since Japan embarked on that in the last couple of years. But Japan's real economy, fading again. And, of course, deflation in real goods and services prices occurring. At the same time, we have inflation in financial asset services and financial asset products. So we have this simultaneous inflation in financial products and deflation in good products going on in Japan, and different degrees of exactly the same thing occurring elsewhere in the world, in Europe, even in the U.S. You know, real prices, real goods and services are declining because real investment is declining, because all this money being pumped into the economy is going into financial assets. Now, it's not going into the real economy, because it's so much more profitable. The way they've set this thing up in the 21st century, the very super wealthy, they've set it up to make more money from financial speculation. And they create these liquid markets and all these securities, and they use their preferred institutions called shadow banks to carry out all these investments. They are owners and members of shadow banks themselves, many of them. But this is a big characteristic of 21st century. Shadow banks are becoming dominant, now have more assets to invest, investable assets, than commercial banks. The government trying to regulate commercial banks is doing virtually nothing about shadow banks. And we're setting the precedent here for another big bust coming. But the rich folks are protecting themselves quite nicely in the meantime here. Another related development globally in the past week is that the report came out that emerging market economies now have greater private debt. Their total private debt is greater than their total GDP. Right? They are up to their elbows in debt, corporate debt, private debt. They've been borrowing heavily for in recent years. Oh, what have they been borrowing? Oh, all the free money that's been pumped into the U.S. and U.K. and Japanese and ECB, European markets, much of which has flowed, used to flow, into emerging markets, pumping up private debt and government debt there. But now that money is starting to flow back as the U.S. and U.K. Raise interest rates. And by the way, all this talk about raising short-term interest rates 0.25% in the U.S. is a lot of smoke and mirrors, because what's important is long-term rates, and those have been slipping up or drifting up for some time now and will continue. But there's the psychological effect. You see, you raise short-term rates, it has a psychological effect, and it has an impact on long-term rates. Well, with all this debt that the emerging markets are sitting on, private debt, corporate debt, so forth, has to be paid somehow. But when their economies are slipping into recession, they aren't generating the income to pay those debts, particularly since the economy, their economy is very dependent on export sales. Well, when the global economy is slowing and EME, emerging market economy, export sales are declining, well, they're not generating the income that they need to service this huge pile of private debt. That leads to real problems, and among which may be defaults on paying the debt, which has a significant negative impact on the financial systems and markets in these countries, and then as well the real economies in these countries. So they're sitting on a time bomb. EMEs are sitting on a private debt time bomb right now. And their economies are slowing, exports are slowing, their currencies are declining, and of course when their currencies decline, their cost of imports rise, so they're simultaneously in recessions with escalating import prices, having an even exacerbating effect on the real economies, on consumption and growth and so forth. You know, one of the big examples of this is Brazil. A classic case example right now, where currency is declining and rates are rising, and import inflation is rising, and they're in huge debt and they're in recession. And at the same time, they have inflation. Well, a lot of this emerging market problem originates in the advanced economies. All the money that I said pumped into the QEs and so forth. Zero interest rates for 8 years in the U.S., money flowing out into emerging markets as well as into financial markets everywhere. But that flow into emerging markets for real investment has come to a halt now, and those economies are in deep doo-doo, and the money's flowing back to the AEs, in other words, advanced economies. That's one reason why the U.S. Federal Reserve has decided, well, we can raise rates now, because all this money flowing back will keep the financial markets booming in the U.S. The Federal Reserve, central bank, does not have to continue to pump QE into the economy, which it discontinued over a year ago, and now it's going to be raising rates. In other words, the U.S. can tighten monetarily in terms of monetary policies, because all this liquidity is flowing back. They don't need to pump the liquidity like they used to here into the U.S. economy that flowed out. Now it's flowing back. The same liquidity is flowing back again. That's really behind why the U.S. discontinued QE, and of course the impact of central money injections, liquidity injections in the U.S. going into U.S. financial markets, boosted the financial markets even more than the Japanese have boosted theirs. I said Japanese, you know, 60-70% from their QE. The U.S., well over 100% boost in stock markets, S&P 500 and so forth, as a result of QE. But now we have an FDI-back form of QE occurring, right? So, you know, those are the two important developments globally here. In the U.S., what has been important as well? Well, we've got a recent announcement in the last few days that United Healthcare Corporation is threatening to pull out of the Obamacare ACA, Affordable Care Act, saying, oh, they're not profitable. Well, wait a minute here. Wait a minute. First of all, Aetna and Cigna and others aren't making the same claim. Why should United Healthcare not be profitable when the others are so profitable? Because it's true, in 1 year, revenues for these health insurance companies have increased in 2014 more than $100 billion. $100 billion in revenue increase. Okay, so we know revenue is the product of your sales minus your cost, right? We have to assume that healthcare, UnitedHealthcare, has enjoyed this revenue boost, just like Cigna and Aetna. Yeah. So there must be something wrong with the cost structure at UnitedHealthcare that doesn't exist in the cost structure at Cigna and Aetna. Okay. Yeah. Well, but you know, UnitedHealthcare says, we're not making any profits on this because our costs are too high. They're enjoying the revenues, but their costs are too high. Well, does that really mean all the cost of paying out premium payments, you know, to doctors for their insurance? Or are there other costs there? They're not saying what the other costs are. Maybe UnitedHealthcare is not profitable because of its cost structure, but the costs have nothing to do with making payments. Well, we better look into that. Dig a little deeper. Don't believe simply what UnitedHealthcare is saying, because I'll bet you the problem is not payments. The problem is somewhere else. You know, maybe they have write-offs, taking write-downs for something, or maybe they have a big debt they accumulated from buying up other companies, both in the U.S. and globally, because that's what these health insurers want to do. They're buying up globally, going on a global acquisition binge, and they got to pay for that. So is this the debt servicing cost maybe here, or is it some other operational cost, or is it the cost of paying for their insured health care? Well, better look at that one. Don't believe what you read, because they're not telling you the whole truth. The other important development, U.S. Here past week, the tax inversions. We've talked about that before on this show. Tax inversions. That's where companies, U.S. companies, buy a foreign subsidiary, and usually it's in a virtual no corporate tax havens like Ireland or Luxembourg or even Netherlands. You know, they buy up a company there and they transfer their headquarters to the global headquarters to that company and say, well, you know, now we're an Irish company, you know, we only pay Irish taxes, right? And then they manipulate their internal pricing, transfer pricing, between the U.S. and Irish holding company subsidiaries, to make it look like their costs are higher and therefore profits less here in the U.S., and therefore they pay less corporate taxes in the U.S. And they transfer their profits to their convenient subsidiaries offshore or to their holding company there, either in the Netherlands or Ireland, which are notorious for this kind of a inversion. You know, the big players in tax inversions have been the pharmaceutical companies, who have been on a global binge. We've been talking about those bandits and how they're price gouging everybody with huge increases in prescription drug costs that are causing a doubling in many cases of ACA premiums and Part D Medicare premiums. Right? They're just sucking the money out of the average consumer here and making them pay so that they can satisfy Wall Street that they're borrowing big funds from to buy up their competitors globally. You see, it's Wall Street getting behind the scenes here with this pharmaceutical drug situation, you know, where they're just ripping off everybody. It's Wall Street ripping us off, you know, in partnership with the pharmaceuticals. Once again, you know, these bandits in Wall Street pulling their crap. You know, you read the Wall Street Journal, and just about every day there's new revelations going on. We're manipulating and fraud. I mean, the business model of Wall Street is fraud. That's the business model. At the same time, their politicians are talking about, oh, we got to, you know, reduce the regulations that were never very significant anyway on these bandits. So we have this big movement. Elizabeth Warren's trying to raise a flag there and stop that. But the train's left the station, and they'll deregulate these banks even more while they continue with their fraud. Right. Okay, so the inversions thing, the U.S. Treasury finally came up with rules here. fact, today, November 20th, about trying to do something about these tax inversions, i.e. these pharmaceutical and, you know, financial and telecommunications and IT companies playing these games, setting up foreign subsidiaries, refusing to pay taxes on all the profits that are offshore, holding offshore foreign U.S. foreign profits taxes is you know, a joke. You know, they haven't enforced that for decades. So all the money is accumulating offshore, and they're refusing to pay taxes. So this is the tax inversion scam, fraud, simple put, legal fraud, right? We have these new regulations that we're just beginning to see. But you know what? I heard a Bloomberg interview this morning, Bloomberg News, who said that, the new regulations don't stop inversions. They just make it harder for these companies to get their tax cuts long term down the road. You know, this is just an Obama administration make it look like we're doing something before the election. That's all that is. This isn't going to stop these tax inversions. In fact, the guy interviewed on Bloomberg this morning said that. No, it's not going to interfere in any way with the inversions that have already been filed this year, of which there's been a whole bunch, you know, going through Pfizer and so forth, right? Tax inversions, pharmaceutical companies, United Healthcare, health insurance companies, Wall Street, they're all together and they're all screwing us royal. All right, the last news with the U.S. here is GMO. GMO. We have a new rule here that says companies, I forget the name of the company, Aqua something, right, can now create a GMO salmon. Yeah, they're going to make a big fish, right, a big salmon out of this, and it grows twice as fast as other salmon, and they're going to presumably increase their sales twice as much. So don't eat any salmon, folks, unless it says wild, right? Because there's no labeling allowed. There's no way you're going to know whether this is a GMO-produced salmon or not. So I wouldn't eat the stuff, you know. Number one rule, if you don't know what's in it, don't eat it. Okay, so those are some of the roundup issues here this week. I'm going to skip, since we're running out of time a little bit, I'm going to skip talking about a candidate's review here, but we'll pick that up next week. And basically, I was going to say something about Donald Trump is against inversions, but don't be fooled, folks. This is only because Donald Trump and another wing of the Republicrats out there see this inversions scam and bad press as a way of interfering with their plans for a big general corporate tax cut. You know, those who are opposed to inversions among the candidates think that, well, you know, why should we just have tax benefits for a small group of multinational corporations like the pharma companies? You know, we should have tax cuts for everybody. We should reduce the corporate tax rate because it's 35% in the U.S. Well, we've talked about that before. No, effective tax rate is 12.2% federal tax rate for U.S. corporations. They pay another 2.2% for income tax, corporate income tax for some states. And they pay about another 2.5 globally, so they got about a 16-17% total tax. U.S. corporations, multinationals, effective tax. Don't believe all this tax rate. You know, when they talk about tax rates, 35%, that's like saying, "Oh, the unemployment rate's only 5%." Well, that's a bogus figure too. 5%. That's the U3 unemployment rate. You know, you got to look at the U6. And I believe there's such a thing that they should be talking about a U9, which means U9, if you look at hidden unemployment and the shadow economy and everything in the U.S., we still have about 15, 16 million unemployed in this country. Okay, so we'll talk more about Donald Trump and inversions and the Republicans and their tax maneuvers here next week, flat tax and all that nonsense. All right. That covers us here for our economic review and roundup. Let's move on here and talk about TPP, as I promised last week we would get into. Okay, TPP. Last week I talked about the history and evolution of free trade, neoliberalism, twin deficits. And we started at the end to just start getting into the TPP itself, section by section. You know, there's 30 chapters, the TPP. The original document is 5,554 pages. Well, there's no way I'm going to be able to inspect all that. And then there's annexes and schedules, supplementary material there. And then there's this thing that I've seen called the guidance document, you know, which a few months ago, no one knew exactly what that was. What is the guidance document? In fact, even Senator Sessions in the U.S. Senate said, well, what is this guidance? We haven't seen this thing, but apparently there's a guidance document that interprets the 5,554 pages. Hmm? Well, I don't have a guidance document, so I can't comment on that. And I'm not going to read 5,554 pages either, which is what they hope. So how do we find out what's going on here? Well, there's two official documents. One is Obama's statement that's on his website here about, what a great deal this TPP is. It's a new type of trade deal, quote, unquote. It's different. Yeah, it's different, all right. We'll talk about that. And then there's the U.S. Office of Trade, which has a I think 20-some page summary, and if you read between the lines of the Office of Trade, you can get an idea of some of the problems here with this TPP. Let's talk about some of these chapters specifically. First of all, I want to talk about chapters 27 and 28. As you may have heard, TPP and free trade is a direct challenge to our democratic institutions and popular sovereignty and the whole idea of representative government, because this is a kind of TPP provides for the beginning, I believe, of the formation of a new global government, global corporate government, and global corporate institutions that sit over and above the national institutions and take precedence over them, as we will see. I believe this agreement that was signed October 4th in Atlanta, Georgia, the U.S. signed the TPP, constitutes the beginning of a new kind of corporate government. You know, and to some extent, you know, the big corporations, financial, non-financial, they are really global now, and they have outrun these national institutions that they had pretty much crafted to their needs, you know, corporate personhood and all that stuff, and Citizens United and, you know, buying the institutions and so forth. That's not to say that they've abandoned the national forms of political institutions as a way to promote their interests, but they realize that these national forms are too limited now, and they can't get all the different national forms to agree and change quickly enough to satisfy their profit motives. So they are now using these free trade agreements to create supranational institutions, corporate-dominated institutions. And to the extent that these institutions exist and develop, the authority and the power that they have over legislative and court matters is at the direct expense of the national institutions and those national democracy, popular sovereignty, representative government, and so forth. And I'll explain why that is so. But if you look at the TPP agreement, chapters 27, sets up this commission, which is really an executive legislative body. Yes, of this new form of global corporate government. By the way, if you want to read my views on this, I just published an article on Telesur, which has been picked up by Counterpunch and ZNet and some other blogs, called TPP, the New Global Corporate Government, where I look at these two chapters, 27 and 28 in particular, and make this argument that what happened on October 4th in Georgia was a constitutional convention, founding convention for global corporations, I believe, with this TPP. It's the beginning. And, it's the creation of a new corresponding dual form of government, dual power, you might say, at a higher level. And we're going to see continued emergence and evolution of this higher-level corporate form of government over time at the expense of national institutions. We already see it with TPP. Okay, so we've got this Chapter 27, TPP, which, by the way, claims is a living agreement. In other words, we got 12 countries involved in it now, but the anticipation is more will join. The TPP in its current form is going to be debated in Congress and voted up or voted down, right? But wait a minute, it's a living document, a living agreement, and more are going to join. As other countries join, they're not going to negotiate changes. They're not just going to sign on. So there's going to be more changes to the TPP. Does that mean that the U.S. Senate and government will ratify, re-ratify every time there's a change? Or will, the lawyers and CEOs and bureaucrats who are changing it, in the TPP, change it at will? We may ratify something here, and then a year from now, it's going to be even more onerous than it is. And, politicians are going to conveniently figure, ignore it and so forth, let it happen, et cetera. So it's going to creep. We're going to have power creep by the corporations here because it's a living agreement, as they say. Okay, some other comments on this commission. We really don't know much about this commission from the U.S. Trade Office a summary here. Maybe it's in the secret guidance document. I don't know. But to me, it looks like a kind of a corporate global Politburo, right? We don't know how the members of the commission are going to be selected, what are going to be their terms of office, who's going to choose them, how are they going to be chosen, can they be relieved, who are they accountable to? If they can be relieved from office, what's the process, right? By whom? How? Can they meet in secret? Yes, we know that much. What are the rules for the decision-making and for their operations? We don't know anything about this. Whoa, this is, kind of reminds me of the old Soviet Politburo. No one knew what they were deciding and meeting on and so forth, right, how they were selected, et cetera. It's a corporate Politburo. That's what this commission is. Ah, but it has legislative and executive authority, both. Oh, no separation of powers here, by the way, right? Interesting, this commission. It has the power to make the changes, to negotiate new entrants to the agreement countries, right, and make changes in the terms and conditions of this in the process. Or however, it's a living agreement, right? Pretty damn dangerous, I think. Okay, so what about Chapter 28, which is the Investor-State Dispute Settlement, ISDS it's called, which is really a tribunal, right? Courts, right? Corporate courts of various kinds, and I call them KKKs, right? Corporate courts. What's the deal with them? Well, this is a new judiciary, by the way, because it will take precedence over national decisions by our court, national court system, right? It violates Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, in which it said that, the Constitution says that the U.S. judiciary is supreme. here in these kind of judicial review. Ah, but the decisions by that come out of the TPP are not subject to judicial review by national courts or whatever. Well, that's a direct violation of the U.S. Constitution. What are we doing here? Well, not we. What are they doing? You know, well, what they're doing is, you know, U.S. Constitution and national democracy and popular sovereignty is an obstacle to this continued global corporate capitalist expansion and profit-making. That's what it is. All right, so these tribunals, these panels as they call them, right, they're courts, are going to be composed of three trade experts. Experts, well, what constitutes an expert? You know, who are these people? You know, how will they be selected? What are the terms of office? Whose interests are they going to represent? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's chapter 28. They can sue national governments. Corporations can go into these IS, you know, investor state dispute settlement, can go into these courts and sue governments. And decisions aren't subject to review by our national court system, right? We know, even from the U.S. Office of Trade, that there could be secret hearings. There's an option that calls for secret hearings by these courts, right? Oh, but there are final public reports that will be issued, so you can see what the decision was after the fact. But you don't get to see what's going on until it's already been decided, right? Oh, you know, the document says they may, these courts may consider public input. May does not mean must. You know, they'll be very selective. Right? And the initial reports will be, quote, confidential. Initial reports of the decisions of these courts will be confidential. May consider public input. The final report is itself subject to protection of confidential information, unquote. So it's going to be highly edited. You know, it's going to look like Freedom of Information Act blackouts. This is a real danger, right? These corporate kangaroo courts, these KKKs, as I call them, are a real problem, a real threat to national democracy. I mean, you know, we're fighting to retain what democracy we have in this country. You know, corporations are chipping away everywhere on it. You know, this big movement to avoid the court system through compulsory arbitration. You know, is one way of keeping people from getting their full day in court when they get hurt, you know, or sued or killed or whatever, maimed by corporate products and decisions and so forth, you know. That's a trend going on now. We have trends to try to restrict democracy and civil liberties all over the place going on, you know, both in terms of legislation and other civil liberty guarantees and protections, right? The National Defense Authorization Act, the Patriot Acts, all this stuff, you know, and NSA surveillance, et cetera, civil liberties. I mean, it's going on everywhere. You know, ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, really run and paid for by big capitalists. We have enough of a fight going on here domestically to try to retain our limited democratic rights and civil liberties under attack. But now we got this global thing, you know, another whole approach by big corporations. And this is the one that's, you know, you can't even touch, you see. Once this thing is ratified, you can't touch it, right? And we get politicians like Obama said, oh, he's going to renegotiate NAFTA and all that. Yeah, sure. He's become the biggest free trader of all, pushing the TPP, TTIP, TISA, 50 different countries, et cetera, right? These politicians tell you what they think you want to hear when they want your vote, and then they go off and do what the hell they want anyway. Okay. So these courts, corporations can sue national governments, right? But, you know, okay, they can also sue state and local governments. They can sue anybody, right? But the court hearings will only be between the national government and whatever corporation is suing. Oh, in other words, those are the only direct parties allowable. You may be a defendant. You may, the state of California may be a defendant, but it can't represent itself as a direct party. It has to, well, the U.S. government will carry our water here, right? They'll represent us. Yeah, good luck, right? So a U.S. Local, state, and local democracy will be especially undermined by these courts. I mean, take an example here. You know, what if you have a foreign owner of California agricultural land, right? And we have these water drought restrictions in California. Well, they can sue California saying, oh, well, you know, that's impacting my profits here. You can't have water restrictions on me because I'm foreign. You know, go pose your water on domestic U.S. companies and farmers, but not on me. I'm foreign, and I can go through this TPP courts here, right? What about oil companies that have oil fracking rigs in California? Right? Or what about big, wealthy foreign homeowners? You know, they come in, they buy multi-million-dollar estates in California, and they're the biggest water wasters right now, you know, tens of thousands of gallons a month wasted water. Well, you could make an argument, you know, I'm a foreigner here, right? You can't impose water restrictions on me. Well, that, you know, that's home owning. That's less. You're not a corporation in that case. But, you know, my examples of agriculture and oil fracking and foreign owners, corporate owners, is, you know, appropriate here. Or what about if I own a restaurant chain? I'm a foreigner owner of a restaurant chain. And Los Angeles passes a $15 an hour minimum wage agreement. Well, that's going to impact my profits, right? I can say, well, you can't do it in my chain, you know. Here comes the KKK court. They're going to sue you. And the city of L.A. can't represent itself. It's got to ask, you know, the federal government in Washington, please represent me. And now you got a three-way negotiation, you know, because when you have the national government representing local interest, well, the national government has its own interest, and it may forego local interest in an attempt to cut a deal on something elsewhere with the foreign corporation. Okay. Other chapters here. I mean, 2728, democracy. Right? Attacking democracy, attacking civil liberties, you know, local democracy, local government, representative government, popular sovereignty, whatever have you, right? Beginning of a global corporate government, right? Here. A revolution. It really represents a revolution. Wherever you see the formation of institutional dual powers and dual authority being set up, that's an indicator of a revolutionary, pre-revolutionary situation, you know, going on. Historically, it's always been the case, and that's the case here, except this time the revolution's by the multinational global corporations in these 12 countries. Okay. Other chapters. Chapter 2, trade in goods, right? We have a statement that tariffs will be reduced, except in those cases where schedules and annexes indicate otherwise, right? Trade in goods. Obama says he's going to lower 18,000 tariffs on 18,000 different goods. Well, look, you know, and that's supposed to create more competitive U.S. corporations because, you know, it'll raise the cost of, or lower the cost of, you know, for the U.S. competition here, and that will create more jobs, as if lowering costs creates jobs. You know, that's the problem with business tax cuts. You say, oh, we're going to lower business costs, and therefore that will mean businesses will have more money, and they can therefore invest and create more jobs, except not any of that happens after you lower the cost. They just pocket it and sit on, you know, the profits and hoard it. Okay, so lowering costs, you know, 18,000 different. Well, look, what good is lowering tariffs by a couple percent, you know, even 10%, when these countries can devalue their currency by 20-30%. Right? There's nothing in TPP that controls currency manipulation. These countries can, reduce their tariff. The U.S. reduces this tariff, and then they reduce their currency by 20-30%, and they got, even a greater competitive advantage over U.S. companies. One of the big violators, this is Japan. Japan has reduced its currency by 20% plus compared to the U.S. and by over 50% compared to the Chinese yuan. Right? They're the biggest currency manipulator we've got. You don't hear anyone complain about that. They complain about, China manipulating its currency. Well, China's currency is pegged to the dollar within a range. So Japan's the big currency manipulator, and so are most of these other Asian 11 countries. So it doesn't matter. They'll do what they want to offset it. And, of course, Chapter 2 allows for license requirements to continue. All the countries have to do is notify each other. So, I cut my tariffs, but I raised my license requirements. It's a big farce. It's a big farce, about all this trade and services reducing costs, making U.S. more competitive and American workers benefiting. Nah. Nothing to do with that. It's about foreign money flows mostly. Okay? And some particular advantage for special U.S. corporations, right? Like the pharmaceutical companies and banks and financial services companies. Under TPP, Chapter 18, pharmaceutical companies get to have 8 years protection on these biological drugs. Monopoly protection. They'll start gouging everybody around the world. And then another 3 years as well, right? Financial services. No limits on cross-border transfers and sales of financial services allowed. Oh, the big banks love this, right? Services in general, the same thing. No quantity or limits on local content or local content laws on free transfer of services. You combine that with the technology provisions, the IP, intellectual property provisions, and what you've got is a picture here where U.S. software and communications companies and financial companies and certain big service companies are now going to be able to sell e-commerce into all these other 11 countries. They cannot block, and data storage companies. It's going to be a big boom to data storage companies in the U.S., because now they can run it all from here. Basic investment, right? You cannot expropriate without process and payment, right? No local content, global money flows, transfers, right? Okay, lots of these provisions here are really pro. One more comment here. Labor and environmental laws, the provisions of 19 and 20, Chapter 19 and 20, are simply we're going to work together to try to do something to abide by the International Labor Organization, ILO, in Geneva. We're going to work together. Nothing for certain. That's the TPP. Everything's certain for them, and for the rest of us, well, we'll work on it. Okay, next week we will continue with our new format. Alternative Visions.